Hi, I'm William. I'm an alcoholic.
William!
My sobriety date is 12/4/24. My home group is Connect the Dots, and I'm from Las Vegas, Nevada. Yeah. So if y'all can tell, I am literally terrified of public speaking. Thankfully, I have a wonderful group of gentlemen to be able to share my experience, strength, and hope tonight. So here we go. So I was your basic average kid when I was younger. Drinking started off kind of early, probably about 14 or 15, not too early. And, I never thought it was a big occurrence. And I think my first touch up with the law was right around 16. And, it was one of those drunk in public, disorderly conduct. And I didn't think anything of it. Thought it was just average teenage tomfoolery. And I kind of swept it under the rug. Things progressed a little bit. I ended up being kicked out of school. And, I thankfully got my GED. And I eventually became an adult. And... probably last month or so. But in the eyes of the law, I became an adult. So during this time period, I had the opportunity of a career, and I go ahead and seize the opportunity. Clearly not for long. It was an opportunity as a plumber, and I took that opportunity, and my alcoholism got in the way. It continuously kept biting me in the ass, pardon my language, and it kept causing me to show up late, me not to be a man of my word, or to fulfill my commitment as an employee. I wouldn't take the job seriously. I constantly show up late, hungover, or even sometimes drunk on the job. And I just continuously kept doing it, not really thinking much of it. And I was actually introduced into the rooms right around that time. I can still remember the church in which I went to. It was actually back in Maine, where I'm originally from. And I remember rolling into a group of wonderful people. They all seemed to have this bright spirit to them. And I can still remember the smell of coffee and cigarettes as I walk into this place. And the feeling in the room was kind of like here. And I wasn't ready for it. I felt out of place. I felt uneasy. And I didn't realize until recently why that was. And I think we'll get to that. So back into my journey I went. I had that one touch up. And I seen how these people were. And honestly, I truly didn't believe that it was real. I didn't believe that it was something that was sticking. I didn't think that these people were being genuine. So back out into the world I went. I flushed that career down the toilet. I believe I actually was fired by my biological father. Crazy, right? And that day, I seen a look in this man's face which I haven't seen in anyone's ever since. And it was a fresh relationship because I was adopted when I was younger and he was the man that gave me up. And I had recently made contact with him, had about a year, and he kind of seen this mess of a life I had going on. And the look in his face, just pure disappointment and not knowing what to do. But on a business standpoint, he had to let me go. And so that was one career down the toilet. I kept having more run-ins with the law back in Maine. And I finally hit a point where I was like, all right, I got to go, or otherwise I'm going to go to prison. And so I made that geological change, in which I'm sure a few of us have made before, and I ran from my problems. So I go out to Vegas, and you know, I used to crack jokes about that too. I came to the city of sin to get my life straight. Let me tell you, it didn't quite work out that way. But I did that, and I started another career as an electrician. And it's going great. It's wonderful. And then I turned 21. And I found myself on my 21st birthday sitting at a bar. And on my 21st wake up, I didn't know what happened. I was trying to piece together the night in which I thought I had a great time. Well, I didn't. Luckily, I didn't pick up any charges, and I wasn't in the face of the law yet. During that time of 21, I picked up a home invasion charge, and I don't know how I came unscathed from that one. But, you know, by the grace of God, I didn't end up getting convicted. At that point, I really took a serious look at my life, and, you know, I started turning stuff around. And for about a year or two, I did just that. I really kind of devoted myself to my work, and I started doing, as we call it, white-knuckling it. And as time went on, I did become irritable, restless, and discontented. I just couldn't live in my own skin. I just felt uneasy with myself, and I wanted a way out. And I took the way out through drinking. And it was a downfall. It was really about a 10-year, just abysmal time in my life. I just didn't know really how to describe it. And during this time, I want to say probably about 8 years in, I tried killing myself. I had a shotgun in my mouth, and I pulled the trigger. I'm glad the shell didn't fire. And at that time, that was a very, very low point in my life. I didn't know what to do with myself, and it felt like the easy way out. I'm so grateful that that didn't happen the way that I planned. I ended up going to a Salvation Army to go ahead and straighten my life out, and I had the greatest of intentions. I did. But I didn't have my mind right at that point, you know? And I was about 3 weeks in and thought that I had it on my own. Thought I had a couple tools that I'd learned at this facility. So off I went. And, you know, once again, it was like the cycle goes. I find a job, I get some money, I find a girl. And I tore the house all down on my head once again. I started drinking, and I'm drinking on the job, and I'm getting fired. Now, I think during this time, once again, I was at a point in my life where I can go left or I went right. And, you know, left was continue on into the abyss, you know, up to the gates of insanity, or left or right. On the right, I can go ahead and try to find a solution. So, once again, I decided to go ahead and check myself into another facility. And this one, it was called West Care. It's in Las Vegas. And they sent me up to this facility on the mountain called HSR. When I'm on this mountain, I really started to, you know, take a shine to what I felt like inside and take a deeper look at myself. Unfortunately, they didn't introduce us into AA. They just kind of walked us through the steps of the tools in which they give you at these facilities. It wasn't until about a year later where I wind up at another facility, and they have these panels that we all do, H and I. I was supposed to wasn't, yeah. H&I panels. And at this panel, I meet wonderful people. And like once again, I found this air of inspiration and happiness. And I'm really hanging on to it this time. It's a true inspiration. Now, I end up getting kicked out of this program. And at the gates of this program, they look at me and say, you have two options. You can go back out or you can go catch a meeting. I went and caught a meeting. And I caught a meeting after that and a meeting after that. And at one of these meetings, I'm full-fledged from reality at this point, and I was tricked into getting up and sharing how I'd got 4 months. And in the crowd, in my own head, I see this man shaking his head. And in my head, I think that they're talking like they're talking some sort of crap about my share. So I approach this man afterwards, and you know, we start strike up a conversation. And this man asked me, "Hey, do you have a sponsor?" And I said, "No, I don't." And so that man became my sponsor, and I have successfully walked through the steps, and I'm living very happily right now with a fiance. I have an apartment, a job, I should say career. And, you know, it's been the happiest 1 year and 16 days of my life so far. Thank you.
Up next, we've got a guy that I've had the pleasure to know all the way since the start of his sobriety. We were in treatment together, so I got to listen to his story, and I've actually kind of gotten a close relationship with him. I respect his program, and I think he's a wonderful AA member. And so who we have up next is Buck.
Thanks, Richie. Buck, alcoholic. Man, super grateful to be here. It's pretty surreal, you know, looking at all these dudes and to be alive. It's beyond words, truthfully. You know, I was talking with some friends earlier, and I used to come to the 12 o'clock Sarah Retreat meeting here when I was like 16, shoot heroin in the parking lot, and then come to the meeting and raise my hand. But asking, like, is there a solution? And I'd be like, so, like, the fourth step's kind of a big deal. You just gotta really dig in. And they're like, yeah, keep coming back. And I was like, dude, everyone here is so supportive. That's cool. And it's funny now because, you know, just, like, full circle, first thing I'll just state, my sobriety date is April 18th, 2022. I am not, this is not my first time in this program. I've been here a few different times, and I'm grateful to have this gift. And to be present and be able to share it with everyone here. And what's crazy about how this program works, you know, my brain is really selfish. And I was thinking earlier, I was like, you know, I just want a cheeseburger. I'm a big dude. I need to be in a big bed. Like, I'm just going to leave. I think I'm going to bounce. And that's just like a logical thought I have, even being connected and in the middle. That's just how my brain works. And then as I'm sitting there drinking coffee, I just see Eric and Bill. It's like tractor beams. And they just point at me. And I'm like, oh, no. I'm like, what are they? And they're like, hey, we were talking about it. We just think you should speak tonight. I'm like, absolutely. In the back of my head, I was like. And it's so funny because God will do for you what I've realized, like what I'm unable or not willing to do for myself as long as I'm connected and constantly searching for something different. My experience is that this is the only thing that I've ever seen work. You know, I've tried methadone maintenance. I've tried to just drink, you know, Coors Light. I've tried to just shoot cocaine. You know, and ultimately it's like all that stuff might work for like a 16-minute window until like felonies start or windows start breaking. And, you know, just being able to be here and like be myself and be authentic and not have to put up like some facade, is crazy, you know. And the way God works today in my life, like a full circle moment, I went to continuation school, at this place called McEwen in Malibu. And I'm walking there with a couple guys who were sober today. And this girl runs up and grabs me, hugs me from the back, and she started crying. And I was like, oh my God, what's going on? Darshana, I haven't seen this girl since high school. I used to sell her and her mom Xanax and blow. And that part was kind of dark. But she's like, you look so good. What are you doing? I'm like, oh, I'm at an AA retreat. And she's like, wow. And her sister hated me. You know, she was like staring at me. She's like, hey, Buck. I'm just like, hey, what up? You know, it's funny because, like, it's okay. Like, not everyone has to like me. But as long as, like, I'm allowed to come here, I should be okay, you know? And that was, like, a full circle moment. It's like, wow, like, we're right where, like, I used to get loaded and make bad decisions, and now I'm, like, here with sober dudes at a men's retreat, which is insane. You know, if anyone told me that's what I would be doing this weekend, there's no situation where I would have said, oh, absolutely, that's not true. And, you know, just earlier today, before I kind of get into what it was like, which everyone knows is going to be really dark, you know, I was talking with a friend of mine, and we were talking about changes and having to make certain choices that are difficult. And then out of nowhere, you know, this dude floated out of the abyss, and it was Jay. And I was like, oh, my God, where did Jay come from? And, you know, he's like, you know, you don't have to make bad decisions or relapse to change your life. And I was just like, yeah, it's super valid. And, you know, it's crazy that these people get put in your life at the exact moment you need it. Because me, like my own self-will and my own volition, it's like I'm going to do what's comfortable, what's the least resistance, and what's going to feel the best, you know? And the only way I'm able to feel good is if I'm in the middle. And that's really what I'm making a conscious effort to do this time. But what it was like, you know, I come from an Irish Catholic family. I grew up in Venice, and we moved around a lot. You know, by the time I was, my dad was the voice of Gumby and was like a cokehead. So he made a lot of money for like 2 years, which was cool. And then snorted most of it, so that was chill. And we moved to New Zealand, and I remember it's like I've, at this point, we've moved like 7 to 9 times. I feel like I'm a chameleon, like I have to adapt and just be malleable because my whole life at this point is literally just surviving. It's like another school, weird stuff's happening with my parents, alcoholism, untreated, you know, anger, therapy. My dad thinks sucks, and he's not gonna do it. And, you know, I remember sitting in this classroom with all these Samoans and Tongans, like in New Zealand and Wellington. And they're like, hey, what's up, bro? How you doing? I'm like, hey, I'm like, is this dude in our class? He looks like he's like 28. He's like, oh, he's been like held back like 9 years, but he's a good guy. Hey, like, don't I was like, right on. All the dudes there, you know, were like 350 pounds. And I'm just like, all right, that dude's on our team. That's not chill. We're going to, you know, and once again, it's like, these people kind of like brought me in, and the only way I can really like have respect was like just being down to like fight anybody or like rob houses and steal cars. And I'm like 12 years old with like 19-year-old Samoans, and they're like, hey, smoke some angel dust, cause it's good for you. And I'm like, you know, I'm like in my underwear, my mom getting called, I'm like shadow boxing in the street. My mom's like, what the fuck? And you know, it's like just that progression. It's crazy at 12, you know, it's not like cute or like, oh, that's, he smokes some weed, that's crazy. And, you know, when we moved back, my parents at 14, they're like, this dude is such a liability, like he cannot come to LA. So they send me out to Mendocino because my uncle grows weed, and I'm like, chill, great. So we go up there, within like probably 16 days, I had like a grand theft charge, stole my uncle's car, who I wasn't a big fan of. Broke all the windows out, got super high. I was riding around with some Norteños, and we were going to hit this house. And I remember I was like, dude, I just want to go, I'm going to get a Gatorade. I want a blue Gatorade. And they're like, that's the wrong color, Holmes. I was like, oh, whatever. And I literally go inside, and I grab this Gatorade, and I literally walk out, and these dudes are like all arrested. And I'm like, oh, that's not chill. And I like kind of backpedaled. And once again, it's like God intervening in my life. It's like one of the dudes was on parole. Murder charges. I mean, like being like 14, 15 and in these like scenarios was like really normal and like a practicing day of an alcoholic and an addict. And for me now, it's like, you know, when you go out to dinner, it's like, oh, like what type of water is that? That's Aquapana. They're like, oh yeah, that's good. And I'm, you know, when you're out with friends, it's so funny too, because this dude I used to get loaded with, Sean, he's having a baby soon, and it's, his life is beautiful because he made this the number one thing in his life. And we were talking, and it was funny. He got served some water, and he's like, is that tap? And I was like, brother, you got sepsis like 9 times. I don't think you should. I wouldn't trip on that. Just drink the water. It's just so funny, you know? It's like we get sober, and it's like, bro, I'm going to get super jacked and just only do keto and just hike Mount Everest like Mike Rude, and I'm just going to be the man right now. And You know, it's like, dude, you have 19 days. Like, maybe just, like, chill. Just chill out. So, you know, the thing which is funny for me is, like, being in the middle is, like, I really get to, like, be present and have relationships. And I never had that before because I had a little bit of time before. I thought I knew some stuff with 7 years sober. But I had been dry, essentially, for, like, 48 months. Like, after that third year, started to get some cash and prizes, you know, like these gentlemen were sharing about earlier. Bought a house super young, had some nice watches. Like, I thought, like, this is it. I'm like, okay, I don't come from money. If I have these things, like, that's the cure. Let me just maintain them, you know, and hoard them. And before I relapsed, it was like the evidence was super clear. You know, I hadn't been going to meetings. I had a bunch of sponsees, but it was just literally a distraction. You know, it was just to, like, not think about myself. And also, it looked good because the image was, like, a big part of, like, who I was at that point in my life. And anyone looking at him was like, dude, this guy's crushing it. Like, he's putting his chick through nursing school. He takes care of his mom who's sick. Like, Buck's the man. But I'm, like, driving around, like, to work running, like, a dealership with, like, a loaded gun in the car and being like, dude, I think I need to, like, start taking Xanax. My anxiety's high. And, you know, that thought comes, and it probably took me, like, 26 minutes to, like, call the shady doctor I used to get scripts from. And I remember I went to go see him, and I was like, all right, well, if a doctor tells me, like, I need this stuff, then, like, I need it. And I remember I go in there, and I'm like, Bruce, I'm like, do you think I need, like, Xanax? My anxiety's bad. He's like, yeah, do you want Xanax? I was like, yeah. And I walked out with, like, a script. This is, like, with 7 years sober, and I remember, like, I'm right here, like, in Malibu at that CVS, and I walk out, and I pour out, like, 5 Xanax into my hand, and I literally throw them in my mouth, and I start chewing. And immediately, it's like Bruce in Finding Nemo. It's like my pupils got all big, and I'm like, let's fucking go. Sorry. And what's crazy is, like, it took me literally 5 years to get back to the seat with more than 30 days in consecutive sobriety. You know, Sublocade shots, ayahuasca, shamans, you know, just whatever. Like, it didn't work for me. And I really tried. I really wanted it to work. And, you know, the only thing that really works in my experience is working with other people. And that's what's made the largest difference for me in this recovery is I go through the book. I'm honest. I'm authentic. Even if people don't like that or like myself, you know, it's okay. Like, not everyone's going to love me. And in doing a lot of this work recently, it's like what I've found is, like, some people may really love you. Some people may admire you. That's great. But not everyone has to be your best friend. And when I was younger, I had so much energy invested in, like, being this dude that was cool with everybody, go to a meeting, dap someone up, say what up to people. And if you don't have 100 friends, that's okay. Like, I'd rather have, like, a few people that really love me and want to be in my life, that I value their time and who they are as individuals, than a bunch of people that wouldn't show up for me when the chips are down, you know? Because before, you know, the only accountability I had before I relapsed, this is probably one of the heaviest things that I always have to reflect on. I remember I was with this dude, Sean, and we're driving. He comes over to my house. We had a conversation before. He's like, dude, I'm miserable. I'm like, me too. I'm ready to, like, shoot up tonight. And he's laughing. I'm like, no, legit. He's like, okay, cool, me too. And he had 5 years at the time. The lies start immediately. I call my then fiance and told her, you know, my boy's dad has cancer, like, very specific cancer. I'm like, prostate cancer, like, he's not able to walk. Like, these lies are so elaborate and specific, which is kind of a telltale sign. And she's like, okay, I guess just go be present for him. I was like, thanks, I appreciate you. And we went to Six and San Pedro, Craigslist, and black roofing tar, the whole deal. I'm like, this is gonna be great. And I remember we're driving there, and I had, like, 6 sponsees at the time. And it was like, I was going through the list, calling each sponsee, boom, dropping them. And I'm literally feeling, like, physically sick, like, dry heaving, my nose running. Like, I remember my right hand started shaking so bad, like, I had to take it off the wheel. And on the last sponsee, this dude, Kenny, who actually passed away recently, he's like, dude, he's like, you sound okay. He's like, have you done anything bad? And I was like, no, Kenny, like, I already got high. He's like, dude, you sound good right now. He's like, do you want to, like, meet up? Like, let's get coffee. You don't have to do whatever you're doing. And there was, like, another moment where I was like, I have grace right now. And I have someone who's like, dude, stop. And I chose to, like, spit in the grace of God. And I'm like, no, I appreciate you, Kenny. Get a new sponsor, bro. I love you. And I remember as we're sitting there, Sean started throwing up too. And I'm like dry heaving. And I'm like, this is my worst nightmare. And, you know, looking back at that moment, I took my will back. And at that point, that was the only thing that was probably going to keep me from not, you know, putting a bullet in my head, because I needed relief that was immediate. And I was so disconnected from this program. And that was the only thing that really made sense. But the part which is scary now, in the world we live in, is like none of this stuff is guaranteed. It was not guaranteed before. But now, like with fentanyl, the amount of overdoses I've had, you know, life support, I'm choosing to not, you know, spit in God's face anymore and like really live in grace and just be grateful that I get to show up today. All my limbs work and I get to be present and an example of what this program can do. But the most difficult thing that I had to learn coming back here was to just say yes and be humble enough to remain teachable, because my ego and how arrogant I am, thinking I know a couple things because I've been in these rooms for a little bit since I was young, is what keeps me sick, you know? And the perception that everything's all right all the time is another reason why I wasn't able to stick around here long term. So now the only thing that I know really works for me is being authentic, being honest, and having a group of people you can rely on and having a home group. You know, I'm very grateful to be a part of HBMS. This meeting's really changed my life. And if it wasn't for you guys, I definitely wouldn't be here. You know, so I'm very grateful. Thank you.
The next guy that's up, I had the pleasure of meeting for the first time at this retreat, and we were just hanging out, talking story out there, and we were talking about, hey, you know, who do people ever say you look like anybody? And I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm Patrick Swayze. And he's like, oh, yeah, but I'm David Beckham. And then he goes on to that. And I just thought that was really cute. But I'm sure we're going to have a fantastic show from David. So let's welcome up here Bruni.
My name is Stephen Bruni. I'm an alcoholic.
Man,
first off, I want to thank everybody that put this on. This is a game changer for me. Every year that I come here, I really love it. And Tommy and Jimmy, thanks for cracking me open this weekend. Show me what I needed to hear, and I know why I'm here. And my sober date's April 9th, 2012. On April 9th, 2012, I was paroling from prison for the second time. Let's see, I had cirrhosis of the liver. I had hepatitis C. I had 28 of my teeth rotting out of my mouth. I had 11 felony convictions in the state of California. And I was paroling with $136 in my pocket to a place called the Four Corners of Death in San Diego. And I would go across the street to the VFW on Sundays, and we would pass out food that was given to us by Safeway or Pick and Save or one of those. And I would keep the food, and I'd have food for the week. And that was kind of what my life looked like. And that was about as good as I could get, you know? And it always didn't start out like that, right? My life was pretty good and drinking was fun for a while until it wasn't, right? And you know, I'm thinking about it lately. And this idea of like when I was a kid, like what did that look like? Kind of like how you gentlemen were talking about, right? Like I had all that violence in my house where the dad would yell and his mouth wouldn't even open. The teeth would stay flinch while he's spitting and, you know, the keys are flying and all the things, right? Did it make me an alcoholic? Fuck, I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. I don't really know what did it. You know, but I know that probably didn't help anything, you know? And I can tell you that my ears were zip tied to my shoulders from the time I was a kid, just ball of energy, just a ball of energy and a ball of emotion. And I had no idea, nobody ever gave me any tools to be able to deal with this, right? So what would happen is I would have this man, and I'm this big, a little kid, right? And this big man is screaming, and he felt like he was 150 feet tall and gigantic at that time. And I'd be scared, and I wouldn't know what to do, and I couldn't fight him, and I couldn't, so I'd just cry. And he'd tell me, I'll give you something to cry about. And that switch you were talking about, they'd get off the tree, I'd walk out and I'd get the switch and I'd get beat with this switch and I'd move on to the next. And I realized that whatever was happening there, I didn't want to have any part of whatever that was. I wanted to get out of there as fast as I could, right? And I can remember the first time I took that first drink, nothing really happened to me. You know, I hear everybody in alcoholics, oh, I got the, you know. That didn't happen to me. I remember going to these guys' house and they drank, and I remember drinking, waking up in the morning with a headache, and I was like, what was that about? I don't even remember anything. I blacked out immediately, and I wasn't really interested, right? Smoked a bunch of weed after that, and then I can remember being at this party, and the thing that you guys talked about happened to me, right? I was sitting in the corner, and all of a sudden, somebody handed me a beer, and I started drinking a little bit, and all of a sudden, I got a little taller, and I got a little better looking, and I got a little more Rico Suave. The girls were coming. I was having a good time, and this is where it got a little different, right? Those other kids, they left, and they went to back home the next day, and then they went to school, and for me, I got in my car and went to Ralph's and stole a bottle of vodka, and we had screwdrivers for breakfast and maybe made it to, you know, and school didn't last too much longer after that for me. And it was a fast downward spiral. I had cirrhosis of the liver by the time I was 21. And I can remember going to the doctors, and they stuck their fingers in places I would have rather them not. And they said, you already have beginning stages of cirrhosis of the liver. You might want to change hobbies. I had heard somewhere maybe that, you know, if you shoot heroin instead, it affects your pancreas and not your liver. So I figured I'd just change it up, you know, switch it up, be creative. And you know, by the time I was going in and out of prison, man, I was covered in abscesses. I didn't have any veins on my body. I was still drinking like a fish, and there wasn't one for the other. It was just both. It was just an addition to. Everything was just in me all the time, and it didn't really matter what it was. I think Tommy, you might have mentioned this. It didn't really matter what it was. It just mattered that it wasn't me that was in my body, or it gave me a moment to just let those ears down just a little bit. I could just breathe just a little bit. That's all I ever wanted in my own life, whole life, was just to be comfortable. I'm a man that's desperately and deeply lonely to my core, right? To my core, I'd suffer from a loneliness that I didn't know I even had until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you guys told me that. You know, while I was in the penitentiary, by the last time I went to the penitentiary, the DEA had tapped my phones, and, you know, it was kind of a thing, and whatever. Anyway, they pull me over on the side of the freeway. They do the whole thing, and they leave. And I'm dating this girl at the time who's a normie. I don't know why she's dating a drug dealer, but that seemed to be a good life choice for her at the time, or so she thought. And then she was going to be going to prison. And you know, I've been thinking about this idea that it talks about in the doctor's opinion that this frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. And I think to myself, well, it sufficed. It just didn't suffice enough. Right? Because I can remember my mother calling me before and saying, you know, it would almost be light, like she would want me in her life so she would tolerate all the insanity of my life. But then she called me one day and said, I, my friend's brother died. And she told me, I hope you're ready to get the phone call that Steven's going to die. And I talked to her on the phone, and I'm crying with my mom while she's crying on the phone with me. And I'm thinking, man, you're probably right. That's really sad. I'm thinking my mother's loss and blah, 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 blah. I hang up the phone and I go back in the house and I keep moving the way that I move. Because it just doesn't quite have enough power to make me do something different, because that selfishness and self-centeredness that's inside me says, I really would love to do this for you, but me first. But me first, and then I'll take care of you on the back end, which just never seems to happen. I sat in the back of that cop car with that girl, and I knew she was going to be going to prison. And I knew she was a nurse, and she was going to get that license taken away. And I thought to myself, I think I probably got to get sober this time. Right, I think, and I guess like sticking needles. Okay, it's illegal. We can probably cut that out. It's probably adding to the fact that I'm going back to the penitentiary. But drinking's legal, like that. That's crazy, right? And you know, I can remember thinking that I was kind of sober when I was in the penitentiary, and I wasn't. You know, and the time and the place came even in there. You know, and I was loaded again. I was off and running. And I met this guy. And I don't know about you guys, but when I meet somebody who gets down the way that I got down, I don't even need to hear your story. I just see you, and I think, yeah, I know you're my peeps. You know, I mean, you're my kind of guy. And we started talking. He was about 20 years older than me, and he was from San Diego, and I grew up in San Diego, and we talked, and he told me, he said, you know, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous before I got here, and I had 5 years sober, and I looked at him and I said, dude, come on, save it. Like there's no way, because I know I've tried to quit, and I see how long I can last. Sometimes it's not even 5 minutes. There's not a chance you were ever sober, because I know you move the way that I move. And he said, I did, it was great. I said, what'd you guys do? He said, we went bowling. And I'm thinking, what? I don't want to have any part of this, dude. Like, it doesn't sound good. But I'd be loaded, and I'd be talking to him about this and asking him about these steps and asking, and he'd tell me the same thing. Listen, stupid, just go to 90 meetings in 90 days, get a sponsor, work the steps, but the same things we hear in every meeting. And he kept telling me the same thing. 2 weeks before I was about to get paroled, I told myself, all right, I'm going to give myself 2 weeks, you know, clean it up, give myself a chance. We're going to make it this time. Then 2 weeks came, and I said, I think 10 days, I think 10 days will probably, yeah, 10 days will do it. And then 10 days came, and I said, 7's going to be a stretch, but I think 7 days will, 7 days I'll be able to make it. And 7 days came, and I said, what's the use? What's the use? I can't do it. I've tried this too many times to stop on my own will, and I lack it. It won't happen. And I got transferred to another yard, and there was no drugs, there was no alcohol, there was no pills, there was no nothing on this yard, which is unheard of in prison. And I don't know what day that was, and I don't know how many more days, a couple days before I left. And I woke up that morning, and I put my sweatpants on, and I was still feeling, you know, like I was withdrawing, like I was detoxing, like I was coming off everything, and it was coming out of my system. Put those sweatpants on, I walked out of the gate, and I felt better like that. I was struck sober immediately when I walked out of the penitentiary. And I know that to be true because I got to the Fresno train station with my little brown paper bag, feeling like a gentleman. Some guy said, "Did you just parole?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "You want to get loaded?" I said, "No, I'm good." And I got back on. And I don't know about you guys, but like that whole like hugs over drug, that is not me. I'm the opposite of that. I'm a say yes kind of guy, right? And I got on that train and I thought, I don't know who just said that, but something just worked here. And I don't really know what happened. I started going to meetings because this guy, Kevin, told me to go to meetings. I found a meeting that was a mile away from my house by the Four Corners of Death. And I would go there and they would sell crack in front of the meeting. And I remember thinking, I'd sit in this meeting and couldn't tell you what these people were talking about. It was a Looney Tune. And I remember thinking, if this is Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm jumping off a bridge. Because I'm not going back to prison and there's no way I'm sitting and getting subjected to this insanity. It's just not going to happen. This man named Lucius took me to a place. And Jay, you brought me back there this morning when you were talking about that first meeting. And I remember this first meeting, and I'd say that's the first real meeting that I went to that I was sober, because it was the first meeting that I found my sponsor, and I found him that night. And it was called Hoodlum's Haven, and I remember, like you said, I remember the literature being in the back and the coffee on the back thing with the bar and the window and the whole thing. And I remember those guys talking, and they did a thing there, you know, where if you're new, raise your hand, and if you're willing to sponsor, raise your hand after so you could kind of link them. And I looked up, and I remember this guy said something in his chair, and it was a candlelit meeting, and I knew he was the guy. Something talked there at the time. And when it was time for the sponsors to raise their hand, I looked in the back, and I see him kind of, like, look up. Oh, fuck, okay. You know, it was one of those. And he told me, he said, my roster was so full, but I saw you, and I knew you were going to die if I didn't raise my hand. I knew, saw the way you looked at me. And he started to work with me, man, and he really started to take time with me. And he brought me through the first 10 steps, and man, he was perfect. You know, for a lot of years, I thought, man, what a bunch of half-ass inventories he did. You know what? He did exactly what I could handle at that time. I couldn't have handled anything more than exactly what he gave me, which was just enough to make it to the next meeting and get a commitment. That was it. I was insane, man. I was insane. They let me off parole early, and you know, at about 5.5 months sober, I kind of thought he was, oh, wow, we're already almost done. I thought he was the president of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was kind of like a bigwig, so I thought that, like, doing the step work, I thought it was kind of like homework in school. Like, nobody told me there shouldn't be a spiritual. I didn't know any of that. I just thought you have to do this homework to stay in these classes, and that's what. And okay, so I just did it. And my life changed. I got a part of a group that later on that year, and they took the big book, and they turned every statement into a question in the big book, and it changed my life. It revolutionized my life because I got to understand this, and I watched this book come alive and slap me right in the face. When you asked me to speak today, I don't think I've shared this from a podium yet. And you guys are talking about sex today. And, you know, years later, I can tell you this. No one's ever called me marriage material my whole fucking life. Ever, never, ever. I've been called a lot of things. Marriage material was never one of those. And I meet this girl, and you know, we start dating, doing our thing, and she says this to me. She says, we're at a dinner. One of her friends says, "How did you know Stephen was the one?" Now, I have a whole list of reasons what I think she should say. Great and bad, rich, good looking. None of them are true, but just for her to say those things would have been plenty enough. And she said, "Stephen's the most consistent man that I've ever met in my life, and I've prayed for a consistent man to God for all my life because every man's been inconsistent, and he brought that to me." And you guys did that because I'm not consistent. Right, and I find myself, and I remember asking Jay last year, I said, "Man, everybody keeps talking about the second surrender. When am I gonna have a second surrender?" And he said, "You idiot, you had one at 10 years. Did you forget?" And I thought, what? That's what a second surrender? And it really was. You know, see, what happened was, I'll try to wrap it with this. I had this girl. I got the girl. If you see my wife, you know I got the girl. And I love her. She's my best friend, just like you guys were talking about, my favorite person on the planet. And at 10 years sober, she goes out of town, and I find myself coming in out of almost like a blackout, and I'm standing in the middle of a swingers club thinking, how the fuck did I get here? What is happening here? And I called Jay the next morning. I said, "My sex life is unmanageable. I'm absolutely powerless, and I don't know what to do." He said, "I've been waiting for this phone call for 3 years. And he had me go to another program and do what they do there. and it opened my eyes, and I hated it. I hated it. I wanted to quit. I called him every day. I want to quit. I hate this. I'm not interested in this. And he told me things like, your second program's already always harder than your first. Keep going. And I had my sponsor in that program going, well, it's you don't know God, that's why. And I'm thinking, name a better AAer. I don't know God. Are you out of your mind? Do you know how far I've made it here? And I had to take this position of humility to get on my knees to just say, maybe I don't know. You know, I don't know if you guys are anything like me, but I can compartmentalize this thing and think that, like, I work all these steps and I sponsor all these people and I do all this AA stuff, and it's like I still have this little nook and cranny over here that's just not exactly the way that I think it should look. And I cover it in justification after rationalization after justification, and I just feel like everything's going to be okay until that starts to come out and it starts to see the light of day. And once that sees the light of day, I just burn my life to the ground where I have the possibility of. And thank God, just like you said, Buck, that Jay told me, you don't have to burn your life down before you change this. Today I can tell you that, like, me and my wife go to couples therapy, and I thought it was so lame. Oh my God. She'd tell me to do these things, and I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. Turns out I'm the problem. I know you guys wouldn't have guessed that, but I'm the problem. And I can tell you that I'm living a different life today. Like, I'm not that guy. I don't suffer from that thing. That thing is not inside of me. I'm more useful to the men that are around me in my life, and I can be an example to them because you guys showed me how to do that. You guys showed me the places to step and the man to be. I follow in your footsteps. And what happens to be is this man who's this absolute scumbag of a derelict, insane human being, one contrary action after one contrary action, I'm turned into a man. And that's something that I didn't know if I even wanted to be by the time I got here, because my perception of what a man was so crooked and so skewed. But I follow men like you guys, and my life just continues to get better. So I'm so grateful to be here. Thank you for letting me share.
So last but not least, I'd like to introduce this gentleman. He used to be our Grapevine representative. And he is the most fantastic salesperson for the Grapevine. I think I have like 5 subscriptions to the Grapevine right now. Digital, book, all of it. But here, I'd like to welcome to the mic, Brian.
Hello, everybody. My name is Brian. I'm an alcoholic.
Brian!
Of all the things that I'm remembered for, I'm glad that you guys are still rasping about that years later. I like to joke about this and we've got about a dozen of our circuit speakers here in the front row, and I like to joke about it's a poorly kept secret in circuit speaker world that when you're feeling a little hesitant or a little tentative or maybe even a little bit of stage fright or nervousness, and before you talk, that you spend the first 10 minutes of your talk thanking everybody that you've ever known, and then you spend the next 5 minutes acknowledging everybody that you didn't know. So I want to start by thanking... but seriously, joking aside, I do want to just quickly acknowledge Patrick's been on Zoom duty all weekend. He's done a wonderful job of making sure that... And we really appreciate that he's making sure that the transmission is flawless for the people that aren't able to join us in person but are here on screen. And of course, David Lester over there from Sound Solutions, who's been working tirelessly all weekend to... I think it's a very understated responsibility that there are people that work so tirelessly and put such a concerted effort into making sure that this experience is documented for the people that want to refer back to it later on, and also as a time-delayed transmission for the people that aren't able to be here that can listen to it after and they can share that experience with us. And when I was young and when I was starting out and when I was alone at night, you know, I would put on the cassette and I would hear Don Pritz and I would hear Bob Olson and I would hear some of the really seminal circuit speakers that were in vogue at the time. And that was a really overwhelming and touching experience. And today, you know, I'm at home and my wife, as many of you know, has multiple sclerosis. She struggles with chronic pain. She's got some very serious health issues. Sometimes she wakes up screaming. And You know, after she goes to bed at night, sometimes I'll be upstairs in the same room that you see me on Monday nights when I'm upstairs and I'm in my office. And sometimes in a more vulnerable moment, I'll feel alone and I'll feel helpless and I'll feel that sense of, you know, I wish I could do more. And then I listen to Matthew Mitchell and I listen to one of his talks sharing about his experience, and I don't feel alone and I don't feel helpless and I don't feel neutered anymore. And isn't that how this miracle happens? Can you all see this? Patrick, can you make sure this gets on camera? Can you see that? My sobriety date is December 6th, 1986. This is a gift that Gary, I won't say his nickname on a live mic in a Franciscan cathedral, but this was a gift from Gary in Phoenix. I met Gary in Phoenix when I came to HBMS, however many years ago that was. He was one of the first people on Zoom to greet me, and I met him for the first time in person last night. This morning he gave me this. These are the people that are sitting next to you, gentlemen. We're surrounded by men of such generosity of spirit and unwavering loyalty and commitment. I'm an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. My sobriety date is December 6, 1986. Dr. Silkworth refers to me, I think it's Dr. Silkworth, as a psychopath that's emotionally unstable. I'm what they used to call in the old days, they don't use this terminology anymore, but I'm what they used to call a 4-9er. Anoush is probably one of the few people in the room that knows what a 4-9er is, but a 4-9er is somebody who takes a certain psychological testing instrument and scores a 4 on the psychopath scale and a 9 on the schizophrenia scale, which means you legitimately don't know if you're lying and you legitimately don't care. I'm glad that that's amusing for everybody. It wasn't so amusing at the time. I was the one that had a number of people involved in my case. I was surrounded by law enforcement and attorneys and their attorneys and caseworkers and social workers and all kinds of other people that were up in my situation. I was the one they said wasn't going to make it. They said that I was in denial. After they stopped using the term denial, then they said I was resistant. They said that I was terminally unique. They said I was hopeless. The truth is they were right. I wasn't going to make it in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't going to make it to C16 at the rate that I was going. And the men and women in this fellowship said, "We'll just see about that. Kid, go make the coffee." They handed me the keys to the Alano Society. They said, "You're going to lead the meeting tonight. Be there a little bit early. Make sure the coffee's on. Make sure the ashtrays are clean." Everything that I know about being up here in front of a podium, everything that I know about being on a live microphone, everything that I know about talking, everything that I know about what I do during the day, I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned that from the amazing self-sacrifice, the amazing altruistic spirit that the people in this room extended to me at a time when I didn't deserve it. You guys have heard the story of my first meeting, the night that I walked into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got sober in December. It was the 6th of December. If you're a fan of rock music history, you know that the 6th of December is sandwiched neatly in between the assassination anniversary of Meredith Hunter at Ultimate Speedway in 1969 and the assassination of John Lennon on December 8th at the Dakota Hotel in New York. I didn't plan to get sober on that day. That was just an auspicious beginning. Getting sober in Minnesota in December is not recommended. It's cold there. Our parents tell us stories about walking barefoot in the snow 5 miles uphill both ways to school. Well, I didn't do it barefoot, but I walked through, you know, feet of snow to get to the club so that the doors would be open so that people could be there to receive the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. Excuse me, I'm parched. I've been vaping all day. I'm dehydrated from drinking coffee. I make no apologies for it. It's 11 o'clock in Minnesota. I've got coffee on my breath. I got nicotine in my mind, and we're having a speaker meeting. So let's do this. We've had a lot of discussion over the past, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, however many weeks it's been on Monday nights. Some people have been very forthcoming. Some people have been very honest about the challenges that they're experiencing. People have been very open about the vulnerability that they're experiencing. There's some people that are going through some really difficult times right now. And I'm going to speak metaphorically for just a second. Richie, can you give me a cue when I'm down to, like, the halfway point? Okay, thanks. There's some people that that have been going through some real stuff, and I want to speak metaphorically for a second because I know that if the most ominous, if the most dangerous, if the most overwhelming thing that's facing us, let's say it's a giant standing in a dark alley with a steel pipe in his hand. And I know that when I walk into that dark alley, which you know I'm going to do, I'm going to be a little nervous, and I'm going to be a little bit afraid because I know I'm about to get my ass handed, my rear end handed to me. And on a good day in fit spiritual condition, walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe, when I step into that same dark alley, I'm still going to feel pretty nervous because I know I'm about to take a beating, and I know that my higher power doesn't really care if I take another beating, and it's probably going to be amused by the situation anyways. And if I walk into that same dark alley, feeling fit and spiritual, walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe, with God, and my five AA buddies behind me, guess what? That giant with the steel pipe is going to be on its back begging for mercy. Please do not underestimate what can be accomplished when you have the support of your brothers and sisters in this fellowship. I, like a lot of people, I question my confidence. I struggle with my faith. I go through periods where I feel weak and when I feel vulnerable. I go through periods where I question whether or not I have the skill or the intestinal fortitude to do that. I do that with myself just like many of us do. I don't dare question that about you. I wouldn't dare do that because I know what collectively we are capable of. You want to know why Gary made this for me? It wasn't because we love each other, even though we do. He made this for me because this experience is our experience. This number that you see here, that's our sobriety. The truth is I would not be standing here without the love, support, and kindness of the people that are in these rooms. I walked in last night. I came in late. My flight was delayed. I was stumbling through the front row. I probably disrupted Richie's opening remarks, and somebody said, "Hey, Brian," and I turned around, and Bill was there grabbing me to greet me, and Jay was sitting next to him, and Lamb was sitting next to him, and Michael Rain was sitting next to him, and I turned around, and Andrew was over there, and I turned around, and Eric was over there. These are people that I'm meeting in the flesh for the first time, and that was better than walking the main event at WrestleMania. To have that kind of unwavering loyalty and to have that kind of genuine, "I'm glad to see you." This is the only place where people are glad to see me. And I don't mind saying this on a live mic. When I go to meetings back home, and you guys know that I'm from Minnesota, that's no secret. But when I go to meetings back home, it's always, "Nice to see you." But to be a part of this group and to be a part of the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag for the last several years, thank you, has been such a welcoming and hospitable experience, and I wish that for all of us. I'm going to shift gears here for a second because I want to stay true to our retreat leaders and talk about some of the topics from this morning. So I was going to do this on Monday night, but I'll do it now. I just want to take a few minutes and tell you about my dad, if that's okay. Can you grab me a paper towel?
Yes.
Thank you, Matthew. My dad was not an alcoholic. Quite the contrary, my dad was what they used to call a teetotaler. We don't hear that term anymore. Thanks. But he was somebody who never tasted liquor. It became the running joke in our family because we had this guy that never drank, never smoked, never used a drug, licit or not. And he had three children. We're all alcoholics. We all have addiction. There's more than a half a dozen rehabs in between the three of us, and God knows how many arrests and incarcerations. I don't know how many, but it's a significant amount. And I'm the oldest. Can you tell? And so when alcoholism came to visit me, which it came at a very, very early age, I was very young when alcoholism came to visit, and it really was difficult for him. I think about all the times that he'd walk into the bathroom and he'd find me passed out in the tub, and he'd walk into my bedroom and he'd find me face down in a puddle of my own scatological fluids, and my dad was not somebody who emoted very, very, very visibly. I saw him cry more in the last year than I did his entire life. He told me once that he used to cry himself to sleep at night because he was so worried about me. It really broke his heart. Alcoholism really broke my dad's heart. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1986, I chose not to involve my dad in my recovery because I didn't think he'd understand. I thought, He's not an alcoholic. He's not going to get it. I never encouraged him to go to Al-Anon. He never came to see me take a cake, which, boy, do I regret that now. It was something that I was doing that he was not a part of. Until one day, we were sitting in his office, and we were clowning around and chit-chatting, probably just taking a little break from work. And we were going back and forth and having a lively conversation, and Charlie Berry walked into the room. Charlie Berry was a family friend. I'd known him my whole life. His son and I had been childhood friends. He was somebody that I knew really well and hadn't seen for a while. So I stood up to greet him. And when I stood up to greet him, he looked at me and he said, "Gee, Brian, you're putting on a lot of weight. I think you're probably drinking too much beer." And he didn't mean anything by it. He's just playing around. And my dad sat up in his chair, and he actually stuck his chin out a little bit. And he very calmly and very quietly said, "Brian doesn't drink anymore, Charlie. Brian hasn't had a drink in 18 months. I had no idea that he knew that. I had no idea that he was proud of me. After that, I started to pay a little closer attention. I remember there'd be nights I'd be sitting in the meeting in the Alano Club, and I'd look out the window, and he'd be there on his motorcycle, flashing his headlights and waving at me. He was so proud of me. He was so proud. And it was in that experience of our journey in Alcoholics Anonymous that my dad received the most important gift that anybody that loves an alcoholic ever receives. He didn't have to worry about me anymore. When Bill Cleveland came to Minneapolis in 2005 the first time, he spoke at Gopher State Roundup. He gave a talk, which was a fantastic talk, and one of the things that he said was, "The gift we give our parents is when they don't have to worry about us anymore, and they can look at us and say, the kid's okay." It had such a tremendous influence on me that I called him about 6 months ago, and I thanked him for that out of respect. Because of the transformation and the change that took place in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, my dad didn't have to worry about me anymore. I would call him and I'd say, "Dad, I'm going on the road to follow the Grateful Dead. I'll be back in 2 weeks. "Okay, Brian, have fun." "Dad, I'm going to go ride motorcycle. We're leaving at midnight, back by dawn." "Okay, Brian, ride carefully. Have a good time." I called him a few years ago. I said, "Dad, I'm going to go meditate in Wisconsin for 11 days. You won't be able to get in touch with me unless it's an emergency. You joining a call? No? Okay, Brian, I hope it goes well for you." My dad didn't have to worry about me because he knew that because of the change that took place as a result of what you gave me, I was safe and I was protected. And when my dad was getting ready to take his final ball and have his final bow and have his curtain call in May of this year, I sat next to him and I put my hand on his shoulder and I rubbed his back and I said, "Dad, it's okay. You don't have to worry about me. You don't have to worry and you don't have to hang on for me. I'm okay." And sometimes he would get this quiet smile on his face. And I want to believe that he was smiling because he was basking in the radiance of comfort while his alcoholic son and his other alcoholic son and his alcoholic daughter and his Al-Anon daughter-in-law loved him over to the other side. Now, the reason I'm telling you this is because when it came time for my dad to depart stage left and exit this dimension, I was prepared for this. I knew exactly what to do. I had been there with you when you lost a parent. I had been there with you when you lost a child. I had been there with you when you lost a spouse. I knew exactly what to do. I didn't have any hesitation whatsoever. And when I walked through that door in 1986, I didn't know how to be a son. I didn't know how to be a parent, friend. I didn't know how to be a brother. I did not know how to be a human being. I staggered through those doors a savage beast, wild and untamed, filthy and unkempt. And the men and women in Alcoholics Anonymous loved me when there wasn't anything lovable about me. And they took care of me when I wasn't able to take care of myself. And they taught me the most important thing that I've ever learned on the hallowed ground that we create in the four walls holding us together. And that is that the life we're here to save is not necessarily our own. Thank you very much for giving me a few minutes of meeting time, everybody. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in other speaker tapes or CDs from AA or Al-Anon, please contact us at Sound Solutions, toll free 1-877-893-2777, or visit us on the web at soundsolutionsrecording.com. We are also available to cover your recording and sound system needs. Thank you for allowing us to be of service and carrying the message.